Thank you. All right, I'd like to start by thanking the organizers for inviting us to their beautiful country. I'd like to talk to you about D-Brains on Calabi-Yau manifolds based on the following works, and I'm going to concentrate mostly on top line there, my own recent works. A lot of the introductory material has already been described by Hori and by Govindarajan. So let me give some motivation for spending a lot of time on what is turning into a rather technical subject, but I think an important one. So I think people would generally agree that this is, at the moment, an evolutionary rather than a revolutionary period in string theory. We had dramatic conceptual advances in the mid-90s, and we're now consolidating and trying to better understand and prepare for the next revolution. And to get some idea for what are the important problems, what should one focus on, one can, of course, look back at an analogous period, perhaps the early 90s. And one can look back and ask a question, what work of that period really had the most ramifications for these later developments of duality? And it would be an entertaining topic for an after-dinner talk, perhaps, or something one could argue about. I think one could make a good case that one of the most important lines of work was a study of mirror symmetry and type 2 compactification on Calabi-Yau threefolds. And this was something that one could really do in perturbative string theory and get some sort of deep and fairly complete understanding of a little sector of a particular class of string compactifications, a priori what just looked like type 2b in the non-trivial statement of mirror symmetry type 2a strings on these Calabi-Yau. And one can just compute this n equals 2 prepotential and related observables, BPS central charges and so forth. And so it was conceptually very important at the time, showing that one could really get exact results summing over instantons. But then, of course, the later studies of duality showed that this really was a much better result iterative period at first, that the famous work of Kachrun and Vatha showed that you could really get the Seiberg-Witten solution out of this. And later, very detailed study, what typically called geometric engineering, shows that a large number of n equals 2 results can be gotten out. A lot of real interesting space-time physics is hidden inside this solution, and things that you can compute really using classical mathematical methods, just the periods of a three-form on a Calabi-Yau, and still a lot of technology to understand that. Of course, knowing how to do this mathematics doesn't immediately tell you what that physics is, but this was really a problem that contained a lot of seeds and information about further developments. And so one might try to go around and look for analogous problems, and certainly something that we seem to be stuck on, which is quite important, would be some analogous source of good and fruitful n equals 1 models. So how can we find large classes of n equals 1 models? What would be some sort of analogous interesting exact results that would maybe help us in studying n equals 1, or at least helps us to frame good future questions? And of course, the first thing to realize is that, well, n equals 1 is a lot harder than n equals 2, as anybody that's worked on it knows, but hopefully not infinitely harder. Now, this was really intensively studied in the first superstring revolution. One can just compactify the heterotic string on that Calabi-Yau and get n equals 1 theories, and a lot of work was done on this. You need a vector bundle, you need to embed the spin connection in the gauge group, or you need to generalize that into some general choice of vector bundle, and there are a lot of possibilities, and even the basic questions of not just classifying in some sort of very detailed way, but even just kind of roughly what are the possibilities that you're allowed to use were, very, much work was done, but not a great deal of, not the sort of understanding we gained of Calabi-Yau manifolds. So already at that level, we really have a fair amount to do. And now, of course, in the light of brains and dualities, we have other ways of working on models which either are directly, you know, related or literally dual to those. I'm, of course, going to talk about brains under Clavier. One can work on F-theory on fourfolds. And although one at first thinks, well, these are going to really be, you know, very different and really provide some, you know, maybe you'll just, you know, kill this problem very quickly from this new point of view. As you study it, you start to realize that these are pretty closely related descriptions. And I'm going to try to be precise about that. And one reason for this is that some of the standard interesting strong weak dualities in 10 dimensions actually turn into weak dualities in 4 dimensions, such as type 1 heterotic. And that's not to say that you don't need information from all of these pictures, but it's to say that one of the basic questions about duality is just to be able to relate these various pictures in the weak coupling limit. Brain constructions really do tend to be equivalent in a well-defined limit to vector bundles. F-theory is known to be equivalent to certain vector bundles. And one needs really control over that, even classical version of the problem. Then one can go on to ask the sort of questions. And the sort of prototype or the beginning of the, I think, investigations I'm going to talk about are to try to duplicate the success one had for the n equals 2 mirror symmetry, the type 2, that one was really summing instantons and solving exact streaming problems just in terms of classical results. And so to what extent can one hope to do that for n equals 1? And the answer is that you actually can do it for the problems that you would think you might be able to do it for n equals 1, which is not as much as n equals 2, but for problems that just involve finding the potential, finding the moduli space of supersymmetric vacua. So that's the classic problem of d equals 4 n equals 1 gauge theory that you can really get good results on. And the brain version of that problem is basically to classify BPS brains. If you derive a explicit world volume theory, then generically it will obey the constraints of n equals 1 supersymmetry, and each vacuum of that theory would be some BPS brain configuration. I'm just going to talk about the classical case, and where one's looking at classical vacua, and there really is a precise answer to the question, what are the BPS n equals 1 brains on a Clavier, purely in terms of large volume results? And I'm going to try to explain what it is during this talk, because it's certainly not going to mean anything when I put up this precise answer at first, I think. So by using mirror symmetry, at least, you know, when there's a mirror, we can reduce the general question to looking at B-type brains. I'll explain why we'll do that in a second. Those are the ones which did correspond to bundles on the Clavier. And so the claim is that a B-type BPS brain on a Clavier with some definite complex structure in Kähler moduli is a pi stable, some stable object in the derived category of coherent sheaves on M. Okay, so that's a mouthful. So what does that mean? Okay, so the starting point is much more physical than that, and although this really draws on a great deal of mathematics, and especially the work of Koncevich, we certainly did not start out thinking that any of that mathematics was directly relevant. The starting point are really non-normalization theorems. So you grant that you can know something about these things at large volume, and you ask, well, how, to what extent is this a valid description of brains in the stringy regime? And you can, we started off by comparing large volume and stringy results in the style that Govindarajan referred to. And on very general grounds, one has non-normalization theorems in this context of the type 2 string. And so for the B brains in particular, now I should say that, just remind you all that these problem of finding vacua of n equals 1 theory splits up into two parts. And one has a superpotential, you know, one has some chiral superfields in gauge group, and one first solves F flatness. And these are some holomorphic equations, some holomorphic gauge identifications. And then you take those guys and you try to solve the D flatness condition, some Fi terms in the general case. I've written this. And there are, in all the cases where one has specific D flatness conditions, and certainly the case of explicit supersymmetric gauge theories that come out of D brains, one can show, and I'm not going to go into the details of this, it's actually a well-known mathematical thing, that there are simple stability conditions, simple inequalities involving the the, say, ranks of gauge groups and the FI terms to tell you when such solutions exist and when they don't. And so the type of non-normalization theorem that is applicable in this Calabi-Yau context is that this F-flatness structure on the world volume of the brain, we're going to be more abstract about what we mean by this, but you can just think of supersymmetric gauge theory for now, only depends on the complex structure and doesn't depend on the Kähler moduli. And so this is something which must be exact at large volume in some sense. And similarly, this D-flatness condition only depends on the Kähler structure for a B-brain, and so certainly it's going to get stringy corrections. And there was a large volume analog of D-flatness, which is a stability that enters the Donaldson-Uhlenbeck-Yau theorem. But again, I just will not go into any detail to save time. And what this is telling you is that you know that's going to get changed if for a stringy Calabi-Yau. It's going to get Roelche instanton corrections. And on the other hand, mirror symmetry immediately tells you that this condition is only going to depend on the complex structure for the A picture, the special Lagrangian brains. And so the special Lagrangian side should be a much more profitable way to understand these conditions. And we're going to try to combine. So the basic problem of understanding the things at large volume is to combine this B picture, where this side is exactly large volume, with this A picture, where this thing is exactly large volume. And so there's a lot of structure up here. And then the test, the sort of physical problem that we'll solve is to say, well, you know, the spectrum at some general point is actually different from the large volume spectrum because of the existence of lines of marginal stability. Again, something which was much studied in N equals 2 gauge theories. And as we vary these D-flatness conditions, this is the prototype. Say you have one field of charge 1 here. As the FI term goes from positive to negative, you lose the possibility of solving this equation. And so the character of the possible supersymmetric vacua change. And that type of phenomenon is directly responsible for the corresponding marginal stability lines of the D-brain wheel volumes. So that's the sort of prediction we want to make. Okay, so how do we do it? The F-flat part, since that's sort of in this B picture manifestly independent of Kähler moduli, there's a clear way to simplify the problem, which is just immediately say, let's look at the topologically twisted open string theory. And this should be able to get for us that data which we can compute exactly at large volume. And I'm going to get into a little bit more detail. This was first studied by Witten many years ago. And the type of result, which I'll come back to shortly, is that topological B boundary condition would be just a holomorphic bundle. So I specify the complex structure of some vector bundle or some sheaf on the Calabi-Yau, and no further structure. And the states, the open strings in this topological theory, are the Ramon sectors. So they're massless fermions associated to a pair of brains. Again, I'll come back to that. And so that's the sort of large volume answer that, we may not know how to compute a priori, but some mathematician knows, and that's some progress. You can go down the hall and get some help. And on the other hand, after some study of this problem, you realize that this is actually not the answer every place in Kähler moduli space. And I'll come back to a specific example of this. But it just turns out that you follow the sort of comparisons that Govindarajan made in his talk, and you find that not all of the brains at the Gapner point correspond to holomorphic bundles or even coherent sheaves. There are just more general things in there. And so what are they? And you can trace the appearance of these more general things and the fact that there's some subtlety here down to the fact that we're trying to make some statement, so something which is true at large volume, true every place in Kähler moduli space. Well, it can't depend on Kähler moduli, obviously. But when you say what you mean by a brain or an anti-brain, you actually implicitly are using the Kähler moduli. And so brain, you would want to say, according to what I just said, is coherent sheaf. And anti-brain is some sort of anti-object, some bundle on the anti-six brains wrapping the Calabi-Yau. And on the other hand, that definition is very specific to saying that you're at large volume, and it's the six brain charge that controls whether something is a brain or an anti-brain. More generally, you just have to look at the BPS central charges of brains. And you're going to want to say that if And so n equals 2 BP essential charges, of course, are complex numbers. The tension of a brain is the absolute value, but they have this phase that tells you which n equals 1 supersymmetry is unbroken. And two guys can both be considered brains if that phase points in the same direction, and they both preserve the same n equals 1, but generically they don't. They break the supersymmetry. If they point in opposite directions, that's something you want to call a brain and an anti-brain. So that's a more general definition. That can be used anywhere, but that definition clearly depends on Kähler moduli. The essential charges of the B-brains depend on the Kähler moduli. So when we said that the brains were all coherent sheaves or the anti-objects to coherent sheaves, we had to put in anti-brains to certainly to get all the brains, we said something which really used the fact that, you know, we were at large volume, and we could say what we meant by those two things. And here's a case where the fact that you just cannot make that distinction in general is much clearer in the special Lagrangian picture. So the A picture, the mirrors of all of these guys are going to be various three brains. You can look at this pair of three brains you're comparing, and the central charge is then just the integral of this holomorphic three form. Locally, say near some interesting intersection, we'll just find coordinates where it just looks like that. And it's just basically the sum of three phases of how you've taken a real slice in these three complex dimensions. So we'll say this guy has central charge zero, and then this guy has some phase of its central charge delta theta, and then they stretch off into the rest of the Calabi-Yau in some way determined by the global geometry. They minimize their volume. So now you start varying the complex structure in this A picture moduli, and they embed in different ways. In special Lagrangian manifolds, this form is varying, and you just vary this relative phase. And you see that as you vary, you can go continuously from the two brains being lined up or almost lined up to the two brains really being anti-aligned if the geometry of the Calabi-Yau moves around in that way. And so it's just not natural to pick out just the brains and just the anti-brains. You really have to do something more general. Okay, so now you might say, well, maybe we should just accept that and just switch over to the special Lagrangians. Maybe those are better. And that might be a reasonable approach, but the difficulty in doing this, of course, is that now the superpotential in this language is getting lots of disk instanton corrections. So you have another problem to solve, which you just, was solved for you in some sense in this B-brain picture. The superpotential was exact at large volume. That's the reason I'm sticking to the B picture in this talk, is to avoid having to solve that problem, or at least to foist it off on the mathematicians. So I'll be able to say more about what those superpotentials are, but to say that the answer is the same as at large volume, you want to be in the B picture. Okay, so how do we deal with this problem? Well, it turns out that there already is a way to deal with it, and in fact, in some sense, the consideration I just told you is why in this famous 94 homological mirror symmetry proposal of Kontsevich, he had to talk about the derived category of these coherent sheaves and not coherent sheaves. And so what is this derived category and how does it help us in this case? Well, I'm going to go into a bit more detail, but I'll just tell you the basic idea first and then the basic construction. So it's very much like K-theory in the sense that K-theory, we're all now familiar with, is a way of talking about brains and anti-brains on the same footing by taking pairs of brain, and then objects we'll interpret as anti-brains, and then saying that if we add canceling BB bar, brain anti-brain pair, we're going to consider that the same class, the same topological class of object to define a class in K-theory. So that's certainly what we want to do. That can talk about brains and anti-brains. And it turns out that what this derived category does for you is it does this. It allows you to add brains and anti-brains and that's in a similar way, but it keeps track of all the massless fermions between this pair of brains. And this might seem like an amazing thing to be able to do. So from K-theory, you can get index theorems. That's the basic statement of K-theory. And this is getting more. This is really keeping track of both coralities of fermions. And so it's a a great deal more structure, enough structure to make it hard to work with, but it is a well-defined thing. And an example of that structure is to say that two points, well, what are the massless fermions between two points? Well, if it's the same point, there's a fermion, obviously a massless fermion. If there are two different points, there's no massless fermionic string. So it changes depending on whether it's the same or different points. So to keep track of that, every point has to be a different object in this derived category. The index stays the same, but the number of massless fermions changes as I consider different pairs of points. And so this is really something that knows a lot about which glob be out. And so far, the flavor of results, it's not true that this derived category of coherent sheaves is different for each glob be out, but they have to be very closely related. It seems like they essentially have to be the same from the point of view of string theory. For example, if one is a flop of another, the derived categories are the same. And although this might seem like a lot, this is really what saying that you've got the topological open string theory is telling you, and that you should be able to describe all the massless fermions. And so, you know, why is that? Okay, well, the okay, so I'm gonna give a little bit of detail. So the Hilbert space of the topological open string theory are the Q cohomology in some, you know, explicit construction with the Beerist operator Q, it's all the massless Ramon states of either sign of trace minus 1 to the F. So that's what I mean when I say it's keeping, if you properly define the topological theory on the world sheet, you're keeping all the massless fermions of both coralities. So it's more information than just topological information in space-time. Now, there's a mathematical language that gets used. This is going to be where the word category starts to come in, and I will just, again, just to give the flavor of some of this. If we talk about two brains, they could be the objects I described, or some sort of abstract brains, and there's a massless fermionic string between them. We could call it alpha. We're going to say there's some linear space of these. There's obviously a linear Hilbert space of, you know, this massless string states, which we'll denote in this way, HOM EF, so the EF are brains. The alpha is an oriented open massless fermionic string. In this case of the bundles, it would be the del bar cohomology coupled to, say, E star tensor F, so the Dirac operator there. So what we have to do now to go to the derived category is combine brains and antibrains, but in a way that keeps track of exactly which tachyons, if you will, we condense when we combine the brain and the antibrain. But we have to actually, for reasons that will become clear momentarily, keep track of not just the brain and the antibrain. So I might have brain, antibrain, and then some map, D0, that you can now think of as, for the time being, as tachyon, that you give some non-zero VEV, and then the pieces of these two things that pair up would be annihilating brain and antibrain. So that's the basic thing. It will turn out that you really have to talk not just about two terms, but about a whole sequence in general, some exact sequence with a series of maps that square to zero. So why should you do this? Not obvious yet. We'll just take the mathematician's word for the moment. And now if we consider two of these guys, if we had some idea of maps, the open strings between a pair of the original objects, so E is one of these original objects, we can take a whole sequence between the, you know, consecutive pairs in the two sequences, and if it's a chain map, if they commute with the D's in the appropriate way, that's an allowed map between these complexes. And so we're going to interpret ultimately the cohomology of D of each of these objects as the physical information. So this is really just adding a lot of brain antibrain pairs and all these D's that, you know, pair things up. But it's keeping track of that more information, in particular the fact that there are many D's I could put that would have the same cohomology. So this is a very redundant description at this point. So it's no good just in this form. This is too redundant to claim that each of those configurations could be a physical object. Now, in K-theory, we knew what to do. We said that two guys were equivalent if we added the brain X and the antibrain X on either side. And so we want to do the same thing here. We want to say that if I start with one of these complexes and then I add some B in the term, say, 0, and then the same B in the term 1 connected by the map 1. So I'm adding just direct summing of piece 1 to that operator D. Then I want to say that's the same configuration. That's, you know, I just added a brain-antibrain pair, but not just a brain-antibrain pair where I condensed a tachyon 1. Okay, so that's the type of identification I want to make. And that's what the derived category does. And you can see that in particular, once I've done this, if I now define the maps between two sets of these guys as the Q cohomology, where the total Q, so you should really think of this as the Q of the topological open string theory, it's whatever it was before, plus some extra stuff acting on Chan-Patton factors. So the whole point is that once you start taking direct sums of these boundary conditions, you should just allow the queue operator to also act on those direct sums in whatever way you choose. And this is the general object in the topological theory. And then you should take the queue cohomology of that. And that, done properly, is the derived category. So it's the sequences of these complexes where you call two guys equivalent if they're related by adding the VB bar pairs exactly in this way. If they're related by a map 1 plus Q of something, which is 1 from the point of view of topological theory, or if they're related by complex gauge transformation, and then that's it. And so this, then, every pair of guys, every, you know, the Q cohomology here will be what I said, the massless fermions of either chirality, depending on, well, one more step. I mean, so this is what I just wrote down there was a map phi, which had fermion number corresponds to a zero form. And the number that, now we can explain why the number is there. The number there is the boundary piece of the U1 charge, or the fermion number. So in general, I can have maps not just to take me from the zero charge component to the zero charge component, they could all shift over by some definite amount. Say I can take something that shifts over 2, that's a possible contribution to H2 or X2. There are various notations for this. And in fact, this is the best way to define these X groups, which appeared in the previous talks, and to define coherent sheaves. You can now use the structure to, for every single coherent sheaf, find some sequence of this sort where the cohomology is that sheaf, but where all the constituents are really just nice bundles and even line bundles on the total space, the Calabi-Yau. And so all the complexities of things that are not just nice simple bundles and all the moduli of the thing E are now going to be explicit in these maps D in this construction. So this really kind of takes apart the objects and exhibits them, and that's why the mathematicians like this description. So then what we're going to get to shortly is that these, as I've just defined them, are not the tachyons of tachyon condensation. They are really pieces of this Q operator. So we're going to, so every D-brain, I could, you know, if I'm given some D-brain and some, you know, Calabi-Yau, if I topologically twist the theory, I get some topological, quote, D-brain, which has to be one of these objects. And then it has this data up to this equivalence relation. Now, it will turn out that if I start with two such objects, there may be a map between them. It may have a bosonic partner. It may be tachyonic. I'll condense it. And then there is a natural candidate for the complex that combines the two guys that has this tachyon turned on. I just take the direct sum of the two guys, and I put this T in the lower component. And so it's now the equivalence class of those things, which is the natural representative of that bound state. Okay, so that's what the derived category is. And now we can talk about this question of when are there bound states and when are they stable. And well, I just told you how to get all the massless fermions. And so if you knew that they had bosonic partners and you knew their masses, you could decide. If you bring a pair of brains together, is there a tachyon? Is there, for a given brain, a tachyon to itself, in which case it, you would think it's unstable. And it turns out that you can also determine this from mirror symmetry and large volume information. So the way to do this is you first realize that the D-brains, there's a discussion which wasn't done explicitly, but for time reasons I'm just going to say very quickly. The boundary conditions of a 2,2 superconformal theory include a boundary condition for the U1, and that's best described either in Bosonized notation or just in pictures. The D-brain is Dirichlet or Neumann, let's say Dirichlet, some point in that bosonized U1, some circle, you know, abstract, you know, the boson that realizes the U1 of this algebra. That position is just the phase of the central charge. And so you should think of a brain as living on that circle. You should think of a pair of brains as living at two points on the circle. Now, if you start varying Kähler moduli, well, the brains just move around on the circle as the phase of their central charge varies. Their central charges are computable every place in Kähler moduli space just from the known mirror symmetry results. That was just what I summarized on the first slide, BPS central charges. And so as we move around in Kähler moduli space, we can see a pair of brains move around. We know then that the winding number on this bosonized U1 of any string between them is going to move around in some definite way. That winding number is just another name for, well, U1 charge, or the rank of a form, and coming back to this cohomology and D-brain, you know, B picture of brains that I talked about. So if I start with a pair, say, A and B, and I have some Q form, say a 1 form, which would lead to some matter field, as in the, you know, old heterotic string discussions, and now I start varying the Kähler moduli, that Q will just change in some continuous way predicted by this, and then the mass squared you can show always changes in the simple linear way, you know, the mass squared of the partner boson described by this formula. This is just a consequence of conformal field theory and the fact that the fermion stays massless. So this tells you, for if you know all the strings, all their masses at any point, say a large volume, you watch the central charges move around, and you can find them anywhere in Kähler moduli space. And then that's really what you need to know, because once a boson goes tachyonic, then you know that you can form a bound state out of that object. And so combining these two elements of the picture, this is going to let us get the spectrum of BPS brains every place in moduli space, just from these large volume results. Now, there's one more element, which I'm going to have to do very quickly because of the time constraint, is that this problem of not knowing whether things are brains or anti-brains. Okay, the derived category fixed that, and on the other hand, leads to interesting complications of its own, to say that you also don't know what an exact sequence is. So this is the mathematical representation of this matrix, you know, describing a bound state with gauge fields and tachyons. We would say that we have a bound state C is this direct sum, and there's some sequence of maps into C embedding it into this object. And all this makes sense if I knew that B and C were some definite, you know, matrices or bundles or whatever it is. But it turns out that in the derived category, once you don't know that B and C are brains or anti-brains or whatever, this has to be derived out of a more general thing called a distinguished triangle. And just to give the picture, this is a concept which can talk about the formation of a bound state. So in the special Lagrangian picture, I could take one limit in Kähler moduli space where I combine brains A and B. I've drawn some explicit special Lagrangians, and they would, if this string is tachyonic, join up into some, you know, combined brain C. That's described by this piece of the diagram that I just drew. And then I can move someplace else in Kähler moduli space where the same thing looks like this. Okay, so I moved around and the brain B flipped over the way it did on the previous slide. So now B looks like an anti-brain compared to A. But, you know, now you don't expect to make a bound state of C in the same way, but now you do expect to make a bound state of C and the anti-brain to B that will turn into A. So it's sort of a crossed version of the same process. And, you know, by looking at the masses or the tensions of the brains, you could decide, you know, one of these is possible and the other is not. The point is that this long sequence, this thing called distinguished triangle, always stays the same, but it can describe these various possible bound state creations and decays, which are possible at the different points in the Kähler moduli space. And now I'm just going to give one example to show that this is not all just abstract musings, but there are really things which are not bundles and coherent sheaves at the end of the day. And this was already described by Govindarajan, so I don't have to describe it again. This is this quiver with the fractional brains for the quintic. There's some superpotential which we know the leading order cubic term to at the moment. If we knew that exactly, we would know a great deal about bundles and sheaves on the quintic. Even though we don't know it exactly, we still know a fair amount at this point because of these McKay types of ideas that Govindarajan described. And these are the maps that he described that you could compute in his notation, multiplying a bundle by a phi. Does represent those arrows in that diagram. And so now what I'm adding to that is the statement that, let me just put up the picture for reference. So in the large volume, you know what all these guys are. And in particular, if you know, you keep track of the signs, these things alternate brain and anti-brain. So this is this bundle O, which is the sixth brain carrying trivial, you know, no gauge fields. This is this cotangent bundle restricted to P4 of Govind Arjan's talk and its exterior power, except that this is really the anti-brain. This is some rank, you know, six brain charge minus four, which is the anti-brain to that cotangent bundle. And then this is a brain again, an anti-brain, a brain. And so at large volume, when you bring up a brain like N1 up to an anti-brain N2, you expect there to be a tachyon, and indeed there's a tachyon. It's mass squared minus a half, and they can just form a bound state in the familiar way. It's essentially condensing one of these five fields, and you know that there's going to be a moduli space of dimension four. You have U1 cross U1 broken to U1 by condensing that guy. So that's the type of prediction that you can check against Kepner model results and convince yourself that, yeah, that guy exists at the large volume, and it exists at the Gevner point, and I can now test some proposed stability condition and see that, yeah, so you know it predicts that that guy also exists at the Gevner point. So that is going to describe four bound states between brain, anti-brain, anti-brain, brain, brain, anti-brain, anti-brain, brain. But now there's a fifth combination here, brain, brain, which is different. At large volume, there's no bound state if I bring up this brain, brain. But at the Gevner point, there's a Z5 symmetry, and there is a bound state of those two guys. So there's an interesting case where there has to be a marginal stability line. And it turns out, this was first noticed, that the BPS central charge of this guy would actually vanish if there, you know, so there has to be a marginal stability line from that point of view. But what actually is it? So you can now use the, okay, so this is summarizing what I just said. So you can now apply the considerations I went over to predict the masses of these bosonic partners of these, you know, sets of five fermions along some line coming down from the large volume to the Gevner point. And these are the phases of the central charges computed using mirror symmetry. So they move off to be three brains and two anti-brains, all with pretty much the same, you know, central charge if I move off the large volume. And then they move down to the fifth roots of unity. So this is two fifths times k, and they move in this interesting, complicated pattern. The point of this is that this predicts that if you start with those four things, which are all tachyons of minus a half, so U1 charge zero, and a fifth guy, which you can also see at large volume, at some massive boson, which is something of U1 charge three, they move down. And all these four guys stay tachyonic. Okay, so you just extrapolate the mass from minus a half down there, it moves up to minus one-fifth, I think, up here. But it's still tachyonic. And then that fifth guy comes down from mass squared equals one in string units, and it comes down and joins the others down at the same minus one-fifth. So there's some definite line there where it crosses zero, and that's where that bound state forms. And so you know what that bound state is. And using the formalism I described, you can even write some sort of a mathematical description of what it is, and it's this thing. So you take the fifth brain, and it's a bound state with the first brain, and it wouldn't have been a large volume, but it's shifted by three in this Langevin-derived category. That's because this is coming from some, you know, elements of the third cohomology group. That it's, those two guys can form a bound state if it's shifted by three, and then it's just that x, which is one of these general objects I described before. And it's there, and it's not a coherent sheave, and there are lots of examples like that. And so now you really have a, really, I believe, although not proven, mathematically precise, you know, description where you can just derive, you know, the, in principle, the spectrum of BPS brains. And, you know, we have examples, but certainly no systematic understanding of what comes out of that, but you can get lots of specific phenomena and examples. So it's generic in N equals one that, you have moduli spaces with branches of varying dimension, you know, different dimensions in the same problem. You can, I think, you know, this is related to a point Govind Arjan made. The spectrum of BPS brains never reduces to some finite set. These are just my conclusions. So if you give me one more minute, I'll give them. So what we've done is really, it's when you look at it deeply, very much like N equals one supersymmetry. There's F flatness and D flatness, but we had to generalize it a bit to get it to work in this general context of D brains and string theory. F flatness gets generalized to this, you know, general object in the derived category. D flatness gets generalized into these conditions of checking tachyons, which is what we called pi stability in earlier work. And you can calculate many examples. And I would like to think, I don't know, optimistic, that this is a real example of a simple, I mean, you know, mathematical statement, but you know, some precise statement about some whole large class of, you know, effectively n equals 1 theories, you know, all the D-brain theories that you get out of some, you know, particular Clavien. And so here's an example where it's simpler to say something about the whole set of n equals 1 theories than it is to say about, you know, any particular theory in that set. And so that's the sort of problem that we can hope the beauty of string theory and NEM theory will, you know, eventually, you know, let us find simple answers to in the future. So I'll stop there.
Time for a quick question. If not, let's thank the speaker again. There are a couple of announcements.
Okay, the first announcement is about